Thank you. This is work that I did with Pam Ressler. Pam isn't here today, but I'm giving both of our Twitter names. So if you're going to tweet about our presentation, I know Pam is listening in from Boston, and she'll be happy to know that people are acknowledging her role in the work as well. And also, let me just say that I put some information on the back table, which I'm sure you're all going to grab as you leave, about some of our courses, including our Summer Institute on Digital Strategies for Health Communication. I have no relationship to disclose. And with thanks to Shakespeare, I just noticed the lovely rhyme of frog and blog and invited people to the session on Twitter this morning. So people have long communicated the experience of illness in writing, and this has been primarily through books, journals, and letters. Technology has enabled many new ways of doing this, some of them ones that we've been talking about today, and the one that I'm going to be focusing on here is blogging. So the problem statement is that there's a lack of research on why patients blog, what are the benefits, whether patients show this to their healthcare providers, et cetera, and that's what motivated the work that we're doing. One of the questions, obviously, is how many patient bloggers are there? And nobody really knows. Pew data shows that 13% of e-patients, who are people who are using the internet for health information, write a blog about their diagnosis and treatment. And there's also HINTS data that of the 69% of U.S. adults having internet access, 7% report blogging. But all of this is kind of a little bit fuzzy. We believe it's a growing field, partially because of the number of people with chronic illness in this country and around the world. The popularity of blogging and other social media has certainly increased people's awareness of blogging as a tool that they could use. And there have been some health blogs, and I'll give a couple of examples that have been in highly visible media, so that I think that also very much raises people's awareness about it. And when you see somebody else doing it, you think, oh, maybe this might be beneficial to me as well. People don't seem to address this very much, but there are a number of disabilities associated with chronic illness that may make it difficult for some people to be expressing themselves. One of the advantages of blogging is that assistive technologies can be used for that. The initial interest in the work that Pam and I did came because of a colleague of mine who had a brain tumor, was writing a blog about it, and he went through ups and downs through the course of his illness. I talked to him quite a bit about why was he writing a blog, because it was the first time I was really exposed to somebody using that as a mechanism of communication. His final post is the one that I show here in January 2009, and it was continued for a short time by his family to announce the funeral and to announce a scholarship fund. And there have been a number of instances where a blogger is deceased and that family members have continued their blog. So where are these blogs? Many of them they're not widely read. In fact, some of the people who we've spoken to don't even know how many people are reading their blog, because that's not the point of what they're doing. They tend not to be very heavily commented in many cases, and some of them are very, very hard to find. In fact, when I needed a screenshot of Gary's blog, I couldn't even search, knowing his name, and get it to come up. I had to go back to the link in the email. There are a few that are widely read and promoted. I'll give two examples. One is Leroy Sievers from NPR, who wrote a blog, My Cancer, which had hundreds of comments and outpourings of love and support, suggestions, advice, and also many people who used the comment as an opportunity to tell their own story. After his death, his widow continued the blog for a while. It morphed into Our Cancer, and certainly not with the success of his in terms of the number of reads, the number of comments. Some of you may have read in the New York Times Dana Jennings, whose picture is on the right there, and he blogged his prostate cancer. And I'm just showing on the bottom here, one of his posts had 700 comments. I spoke to him on the phone one day, and he talked about that he tried to always read the comments that people wrote because he felt like they were written for him, although he certainly preferred the shorter comments. Understandably, if you're plowing through this many, I believe he's since come out with a book. And not surprisingly, the majority of his readers were women. And he felt great about that because he felt like that gave them a better opportunity to start the conversation with their spouses or partners. Interestingly, one of the things we found in some of the initial work that we were doing is from Dana Jennings to people who had blogs that were not very heavily read, that people uniformly felt like, if I can make one person's journey through this disease easier, it's worth it. Mimi Rodriguez was one of the very visible bloggers also that we came across. She was blogging for Baptist Health South Florida and was prominently featured on the front page. Very open about her experience of breast cancer. She said that she was constantly assured by the hospital that there were hundreds of reads. She never got actual numbers from them. There were very, very few comments. And actually, I display one of the comments, which was from her mother, and then she responded to that. But she felt like it was a very important thing to do, and then at some point just decided that she didn't want to focus so much on this external view of her illness. And then they since went on to look for some other bloggers that, and actually did it in a very, very different way. Dan Zanka is the VP of Communication for the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and as he put it, ironically, became a patient himself, and as a communications professional, used it as an opportunity to talk about his own journey through cancer. There are many sites that provide opportunities for anybody to start a blog, sometimes named, sometimes anonymous, and I can see them in many, many places. And I find examples every place. Somebody followed me on Twitter, and it turned out he was a diabetic blogger, so of course I went and I looked at his blog. I was sitting up at lunch, and I took my own advice. I always say to my students, talk to anybody and everybody. And there were three public health students who were sitting at my table, and I started talking to them. I said what my presentation was, and one of them started telling me about the MD Anderson Cancer Center, where there are some patient blogs. Unfortunately, internet access was so slow, I was having a lot of trouble pulling it up, or I would have included a screenshot of that as well. So in our preliminary analysis of patient blogs, we found that there were many benefits to the individual patients and caregivers, to families and friends of the patients, and as I said before, to other people in similar situations. There certainly seems like there could be enormous potential for healthcare providers. That's something that I'll address specifically. And also to the medical community, if you think about the wealth of information about experiencing illness and the day-to-day ups and downs. And I have not come across too many situations where blogs have been mined in that way. The hypothesis of this, the next phase of this work, was that there were positive psychosocial benefits to some people with chronic illness. And the theoretical framework, because Pam was doing this for her capstone project for her master's degree, and she's a nurse, was grounded in nursing theory. So for the project methods, we went through the IRB process. We have a convenient sample of 41 patient bloggers, and we solicited them through social media, online patient communities, and quite fortunately for us, our study was written up in the Boston Globe, which brought a burst. So the data I'll be talking about is the 41. We had to submit to the IRB because we ended up with 372 respondents to our survey, which was much more than we had anticipated. This is just showing we were written up in the Globe, which was nice. So for the survey tool, we had 34 questions. I'm sure you're all groaning. And we tried really, really hard to keep it as short as possible, but we had so many things we wanted to know. And we were thrilled that that many people went through. It was a mix of multiple choice and open-ended questions, really looking at people's motivation and the psychosocial factors. Also some demographic questions thrown in, and any question could be skipped. So some of the questions that we asked were why people started a blog, how it's made a difference, and so on. In terms of the results, there was a high level of comorbidity, and there were a number of rare diseases that were mentioned. Certainly very heavy response from people with breast or ovarian cancer or diabetes. The respondents were primarily female. We've discussed a lot why that is. It may have been because of the snowball effect with how we were recruiting. And let me just talk very quickly about some of the results. While these blogs were searchable and public, it was really interesting that many people were sharing with their friends and family. They were not sharing with their healthcare providers. So almost all of these were public. There's almost a separate category of the Care Pages, Caring Bridges type blogs, which are private and generally open to a closed circle of people. We asked if people blog under their own name, a pen name or pseudonym or anonymously. And we asked, people almost uniformly read other people's blogs. People almost uniformly shared with their friends and family. Most of them did not share with their healthcare provider, which was interesting because it was searchable. And people gave a lot of reasons why that was, so that their healthcare provider wouldn't be interested, wouldn't have the time, that they want to vent. And some people said, I'm actually angry at this person, and I wanted to use this as my outlet. There's this very interesting parallel with the project that went on at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, where they made patient notes that physicians write available to patients, and the immediate reaction from physicians was, I write things that I don't want patients reading. And so I'm sure you all see the parallel there, so I'm actually interested to find out how that project has evolved. Some of the psychosocial themes that we identified really had to do with the increased connection, the decreased sense of isolation, and that it gave them a sense of purpose, meaning, understanding of illness. Also that it gave them the ability to track their illness and go back and see what's happened over time. We're analyzing right now the 372, the full respondents to the survey, and as I mentioned, we're really interested in why there were so many women respondents. Is that because there are more women bloggers, or is that because of our recruitment methods? Also, that our respondents were English speaking, and one of the things we'd like to do is translate our survey and see what kind of responses we got. In terms of our future directions, we'd certainly, we're hoping to get more out of the analysis of the full data set. And we have a number of questions that we've had really from the start of this. One of them being, should blogging be recommended to newly diagnosed patients who might otherwise not think to do that? And if that were the case, are there particular illnesses or stages of diseases when people would benefit the most? And what kind of training would be necessary to make that as easy for people as possible? Because despite all of the data that we've seen in the earlier presentations, not everybody is technologically sophisticated. Another question that we have is there an easier way that people can locate relevant blogs? So somebody who was just diagnosed with breast cancer can find other people who are perhaps a little down the road, and right now there's no easy mechanism for doing that. And finally, what can we understand about the experience of illness from analyzing these patient blogs? And certainly I feel like I've learned an enormous amount, but to pull it all together in a way that really helps the medical professionals in their treatment of people. And this is very different than the sort of tracking that you get on patients like me, because it's textual data, it's very messy and very complex, and there's a lot there being expressed. But I believe that an enormous amount of what's being expressed is very valuable. I guess I shouldn't have asked for questions. I thought there'd be questions at the end of my talk, but now there'll be questions for everybody. And also, I invite people to stay in touch with us. We're in the process of submitting a paper to JMIR, and I'm happy to share that draft and get feedback from people who are interested in our research. Thank you.